Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Body Wisdom Podcast. We are your hosts, Kiara Orbe and Gabby Barboza. It is so nice to be here with y'all. Oh my God, fumbling over my words already. We are here live in person at my home. If you're watching us live, welcome. It's like having you in our living space. It's so cozy here. Currently, my dog, I don't know if y'all can hear him. He is crying a lot. He's a lot of y'all may not really see him on social media, but his name is Taz and he's 16 years old. And this man is blind. He's deaf. He's does not have a bladder that holds much. And he's so attached to my mom. He's 16 years old, by the way. And just ever since the pandemic, like he developed like this. Like she was always around, right? Because everyone was working from home and she still does for the most part. But today she's not home and he like can like sense when she is away. And so he's like wailing, like this deep like wail. And I really feel it because it's so reminiscent of things that I felt before of like insecure attachment and specifically with my mom. But he's so cute. I like need to show y'all a picture of him one day. I'm really excited because on today's episode, we talk about insecure attachment with my instructor from the SEI program that I'm in to become a somatic experiencing practitioner. The very special Maureen Gallagher is sitting here with us today. And I'm so excited for you guys to learn more about attachment theory and so much more in this episode.
So to give you an intro of Maureen, here she is. Maureen is a licensed psychologist and somatic experiencing practitioner dedicated to the integration of somatic awareness and somatic intervention with psychotherapy and body work. Maureen brings a broad range of experience and training to her work, including certifications as a relational psychoanalyst and supervisor, emotionally focused couples therapist and supervisor, biodynamic cranial sacral therapist, and training in interrelationship, focusing, and integral somatic psychology. In her clinical work, she integrates relational psychoanalysis, experiential, and process-oriented models of attachment theory with somatic psychotherapies. She has maintained a private practice for over 20 years. So, as you can tell, a very well-educated woman. She's so wise, and we're so excited for you to learn from her today.
We love Branch Basics. This product may or may not solve all of your cleaning problems. You can truly clean your house top to bottom with Branch Basics, even your laundry. And summer is coming, thank God. So if you're planning on grilling, you can use Branch Basics to easily clean your grill, or better yet, make your husband do it.
I have not tried cleaning my grill with Branch Basics yet, but I'm excited to do that because, yeah, summer is almost here and we will definitely be doing some grilling. But I have tried it on all of these other things, Gabby. Like one time I spilled red wine on my white bodysuit. We were out in public and I was like, great, I just got this white bodysuit. And I was mortified. I was like, great. But I came home, put Branch Basics on it. And the next day it was like brand spanking new, probably even better than when I got it. And I've used it like coffee stains off of white shoes. I've used it getting blood out of a white t-shirt. I mean, literally everything I've tried Branch Basics on, it's gotten it out with ease. So I love Branch Basics so much. I can 100% attest to the efficacy of the oxygen boost and the concentrate. I love them so much.
One of the other things is that I burn my eggs every morning. And so being able to use something that I don't have to scrub with all my might to get it out is the best. And so recommend there too. And one of the best parts is that one single bottle of concentrate makes so many different bottles of cleaner. So 3 all-purpose cleaners, 3 bathroom cleaners, 3 streak-free cleaners, 3 foaming hand washes, and 64 loads of laundry.
That's a lot.
Yeah. It's a lot just in one bottle of concentrate and just really covers a lot of other products that you might be using. So you can use the code BODYWISDOM, that's BODYWISDOM, for 15% off all starter kits. That's BODYWISDOM for 15% off all starter kits.
We are so excited for today's episode because we have a very, very special guest here today. As many of you know, I'm in the trauma healing program created by Dr. Peter Levine, SEI, Somatic Experiencing International, and we're here with my current instructor, Maureen Gallagher. So welcome, Maureen.
Thanks, Kiara. Thanks, Gabby. It's great to be with you both.
Yeah, we're so excited to dive into this topic. So many of our listeners follow us because they're invested in their growth, their well-being, their health, their spirituality, their connection to self. And they just want to know more about how this all began, how this all started. And so I guess our first question to you would be, how did it all start for you? What led you to this body of work? What was your upbringing like?
Yeah. Well, honestly, as long as I can remember, I was so interested in trying to understand myself. I had had a pretty difficult childhood. I know a lot of us have. But I came from a family with very, very traditional values, Irish Catholic, where girls were not very important. Girls were not valued. What we wanted to do was sort of like, oh, you know, why would you want to do that? Really, your job in life, your role in life is to be in a family, a mother, have children. And I wasn't sure that I wanted that. I wanted some different things, which my family couldn't support me very well in. They found it kind of threatening when I said, at a pretty young age, probably in my preteen years, I want to be a psychologist. My mother said, that's really crazy. Only crazy people become psychologists. That's not something we want you to do. And so it wasn't really possible for them to support me. It took me a really long time to understand that that was, from my family's perspective, they were trying to protect me. They were trying to protect me and support me to move into the world that they understood, not the world that I wanted to live in, and not about who I was as a person. So because of that, and also because my family, we were sort of isolated in that we moved every 2 or 3 years. My father worked for IBM, and as a part of that, we moved both within the United States and then also overseas. So I graduated high school in Tokyo. I had a lot of really important formative experiences, but that doesn't mean they were comfortable. They were often uncomfortable. They were often difficult. Now, as an adult, I value them greatly. I learned a lot. And I've also learned that difficult experiences can be incredibly formative. They're not always easy to live through, but they actually can be important. And I'm glad that I understand that now. It now helps me to get through some tough experiences. One of the things that I learned in my family was my family valued my achievements rather than who I was. And that led me to have a particular kind of attachment style. A lot of people, when they're valued for what they can do rather than who they are, go on to be kind of avoidant in the relationship to other people, feeling rejected or being sensitive to being rejected for who they are. And that happened for me. So because of that, as I grew up, and I did, of course, become a psychologist, I didn't really listen to my family. I went on to study quite a lot, do a lot of different training programs, including becoming a psychologist. After becoming a psychologist, I became really interested in attachment, in the world of attachment, of like, how could I understand myself better as a result of how I grew up? How did that contribute to how I formed relationships and who I was in relationship? And so I started studying attachment theory. That I loved, and it helped me to understand myself so much better and to understand my family and really to see the good in what they had tried to to provide to me, and also how it had not met me, how it had not met who I am as a person, and how I could still heal from that wound. That led me to the more somatic work of, oh, we also need to include the body. The body is so important for our healing, that when we approach healing from more of a intellectual understanding, we grow a certain amount. And then you add your feelings and you grow more. And then you add your body and you transform. And so those things together have all been incredibly important influences in how I came to do what I do, which is to teach somatic experiencing and inner relationship focusing and embodied approaches to healing.
Thank you for sharing. That was really beautiful. You knew so early on that you wanted to be a psychologist. I feel like I didn't even know what I wanted to be after college. How did you know that you wanted to be a psychologist? Like what was where did that interest start to come in?
You know, I don't know if I was super clear that it was being a psychologist. I knew that I wanted to understand myself better, because I also remember being like when I was very young, I wanted to be a veterinarian. I love animals. And I was also attracted to like yoga, spiritual practices, philosophy, religion, a lot of things I studied. And it was probably, I know actually, it was in my first semester of college. And I was taking a independent study with a professor, and I was studying world religions. I was studying the Upanishads. And my instructor said to me, you know, I really want you to read this book. And it was A Psychiatrist's Journey to India, something like that. And he said, I really think this is your path. And it really helped me to solidify of like, oh, all of these varied interests sort of came together in psychology. It was an understanding of being human, of what it is to live a human life, and the ways that we can grow as a result of being human. So I think it was forming across my adolescence, and there was lots of different things going on in there. And it was once I reached college that I was like helped to see of like, this was about a psychological journey, and becoming a psychologist could really help with that.
I think if I could go back to college, I would definitely study psychology. But like you, I had parents who were like, they saw my future for me. They made the choices. Like, this is the path you need to take. Grew up Catholic and just didn't really have like a voice. Like, that was very much lost. And so they were like, you need to be a lawyer. You need to be a doctor. You need to just do this. This is the path to success. Like, that was I don't want to say it was laid out for them, but they didn't have access to the things that I had access to. So they very much like wanted to prevent me from being on like a similar path as them. Like, because now they created this safety for me, truly. They created the safety for me. They were like, this is what you need to do now. And I mean, thank goodness, like I went to college and I did all those things and was able to kind of start discovering myself. Like, and I think that's kind of what you're speaking to, is like the sense of self that you had as a child was kind of, I don't want to use, I mean, such a strong word, but kind of ripped away. And now you are just on this path of like just rediscovering yourself.
Yeah, sort of putting it like a puzzle, right? Like putting the piece together. And my child was incredibly similar in that I was raised Catholic, and Catholicism was so rigid and so had so many things to say about who I was that weren't necessarily who I felt myself to be. And so it really was kind of like putting together the pieces of the puzzle to understand who I actually was. And those weren't being reflected back to me as, this is who you are. something else was being reflected back to me. And what I was left with was, oh, I'm sort of a bad woman. You know, I'm bad at that because I don't know that what I want is marriage and a family and children. And so that was really hard in my younger years. Like when I was in my 20s, I remember being in analysis. I was in a Jungian analysis, which was a great thing for me. And I think I said to my analyst something like, you know, I'm so afraid that I'm just not going to be able to do this, you know, marriage thing. And thankfully, my analyst was like, you know, you and your partner get to decide what marriage means to you two. I feel like I was so lucky to have such tremendous help along the way. People who did reflect back who I was and who I am much more accurately than my family could. And now, you know, many years later, it's like, then my family could. You know, at the time, it felt like sort of like they're trying to limit me and they're holding me back and this doesn't feel good. And now I can really get that from their worldview, they were trying to help me. They were trying to have me walk down a path that they felt was going to have me be safe and supported, but it wasn't my path at all. It just wasn't. And so having people who could more accurately reflect who I was and also help me to believe that I could live my path and be okay. I was very, very lucky to have that. I know not everyone gets that.
It sounds like when you originally, what I was thinking about was what you just said around now you can have compassion for your parents and your upbringing, but later in life you were met with people that could see you and were seeing the potential that you had with what you wanted to do. And at first it seems like there could have been even a little bit of rebellion of, well, I'm going to do it anyway. Like, I'm going to do this anyway. And you got, my family can fall in line and support me or not, but now you're being seen by these new people that you're meeting. And so did that support your way? And from what I'm understanding, it seems like you had more avoidant attachment style patterns. And how do you think that, just speaking, I think there's less compassion given to the avoidant tendency than there is to the anxious. And so I'd love to speak to that, especially for listeners who do feel more avoidant. How did you find your way closer to secure that we're all trying to get?
Yes. And you said so many important things, because I do want to own the rebellious piece. I definitely had that when I was young. And I do think that that was a survival thing. And it's really an important thing that I was really rebellious when I was young. And I think that that avoidant stance, like, it's almost like they go together, you know, like that I was angry and I was like, if you're not going to support me, I'm going to do this anyway, with or without you, I'm doing this. And that a lot of the initial energy did have a really rebellious quality to it. I also think you're really right that we tend to have less compassion for avoidant strategies because avoidance themselves tend to be dismissive. You know, it's like, I don't need you. If you're not here with me, I'm doing it on my own, and are often use exiting or leaving situations as a way to regulate themselves. So, and myself included, if I was uncomfortable, if I didn't like something, if it didn't help me, I often felt inside this like bind, like that meant I should leave. If I was distressed in an interpersonal relationship, that meant the answer was, there was a pressure. You should leave this. This isn't good for you. Get out of here. It wasn't until later in my life that I was able to see that that was not necessarily, I have good intuition. I've had lots of wonderful things happen as a result of my intuition. That one, which I thought was an intuition, was often not an intuition. It was a life-saving, like a survival strategy, but not actually one that I actually had to confront at some point and to say, what would it be like to stay? What would it be like to stay after an argument? What would it be like to stay when there is conflict between myself and another person? What would it be like to stay when everything inside of me is screaming, go, leave, you got to get out of here? So I had to confront my own demons, you know, the part of me that said survival is getting out of here. And in a fight, survival is getting out of here would just be like, go away for a few hours, come down, come back later when you're feeling a little calmer. Or if that would be happen a lot, it might be, I have to get out of this relationship, whether it's with a friend or a romantic relationship. The answer was leave. And as I confronted that, it was, oh, actually, I need to stay and I need to express myself more, express what's not working for me, express my feelings. And that was really hard. It was one of the hardest things that I had to learn to do in my life. And I wouldn't say that I'm the best at it, but I would say that I have learned to kind of hang in there with it and to kind of confront the part of me that says, this would be better left unsaid, which was a lot of my early training. This, just don't talk about that. It would be better not to speak about your difficult feelings, or don't let someone know the deepest, darkest stuff going on inside of you. Now I realize much more that that's a really important part of relationship, and that, you know, the longer we're in relationships, the more likely it is that we're going to be expressing more and more of our difficult feelings, and not only expressing our difficult feelings, but finding ways to express them that other people can hear. Like, it's not just permission to say whatever you're thinking in the most hurtful way possible, that there's a skill to sharing what we're feeling inside. You know, it's unskilled to say, I just want to leave you every time we fight. That is unkind to your partner. It's okay to say that once, but you kind of have to own it as, that's about me. That's not about you. And what's going on underneath that is whatever fears and terrors there might be. And that you just get, I think most of us get, we get more and more skilled at expressing how we feel, and not in the most hurtful way, but in a way that is much more vulnerable. Avoidant tendencies, we don't like to be vulnerable. So it's much easier to express anger than to express the vulnerable, sad feelings. And one thing I would say to avoidant people is, if it doesn't feel vulnerable, you're not really expressing. If what you're mostly expressing is anger, there's a longer journey to go. There's more feelings under that for most of us.
This is bringing on so much compassion right now as I think of people in my life who tend to have avoidant tendencies. So I love that we're having this conversation, and there's so much that we want to unpack here. But first, how is this strategy developed? Like, is it at birth? Is it the child experiences? Is it all of it?
Yeah, it's such a great question, because as I started to study attachment theory really does place how it developed in those years after birth, usually zero to five. I always found that a bit suspect. But as I learned attachment theory, I bought into it. I was like, okay, you know, it's because of the way you were parented and parenting strategies, like some of the ones I lived with, of like valuing achievements over who you are. And I was like, check, check, check. That is who I am. But then when I started studying more somatic work, like somatic experiencing, I was so deeply impacted by Peter Levine. And Peter Levine would show one of the first things I saw and learned with Peter was that often attachment strategies are placed at the door of the caregivers who raised you. And he showed how literally prenatal trauma could lead to attachment difficulties. Having difficulty with birth, a long birth, a birth where you had your umbilical cord wrapped around your neck and you couldn't breathe, could lead to shutdown that did not resolve at birth. Well, that had me and others and Peter himself thinking, wait a minute, if prenatal trauma could impact your attachment strategy, and we also know from research that your parents' attachment stance is highly predictive of your own, what about transgenerational trauma? So if your parents' trauma is impacting your attachment stance and your attachment strategies, well, theirs was impacted by their caregivers, and their caregivers was impacted by theirs. Well, now we have transgenerational trauma, and why so many families have related attachment strategies within families. And it's important to understand that the most important distinction in attachment is secure versus insecure, not the varieties of insecure, of are you disorganized, are you insecure, are you avoidant, but rather secure versus insecure. Because secure attachment is always going to be the first choice. Any child that comes into this world is going to attempt to securely attach. It's when that goes wrong that the varieties of insecure attachment become second choice, second best, but a way to survive. The system that which of those insecure strategies is chosen is a combination of our constitution, all those things we come into the world with, and what we meet when we are born, how we are supported or unsupported. So it's an interaction between who we are and our environment, which is why you could have, it's possible to have an avoidantly attached child who has a sibling who has disorganized attachment. You know, that it's kind of an interesting thing of what can you predict and how does it form? Because it's a whole lot of things that can go into it. What I've lived through, what my parents lived through, what the many generations lived through, and almost all of us have quite a lot of trauma in our families if we go back far enough.
And I love somatic experiencing so much. This is completely like, because I've been exploring my own trauma, and I came across Gabby and I are both NTPs, nutritional therapy practitioners, and we learned about the concept of intergenerational trauma then. And I was like, wow, this is actually a real thing. This makes sense. And then things started to unfold in my life. I was like, wow, I make sense. Like for the first time in my life, I'm like, kind of going back to our first point, our first conversation, like I was trying to understand myself and why I was the way I was as someone who leans more towards, well, I'm discovering disorganized attachment, insecure attachment regardless. But I started to connect the dots with my own trauma history. And so I dove into the books and listened to the podcasts and just learning with my brain, which is so brilliant. But at the same time, I wasn't making any progress, like with my day-to-day choices, behaviors, thought patterns, etc. So could you, I guess, first explain what somatic experiencing is, what somatics are, and yeah, let's start there.
Sure. So somatic experiencing is the work of Peter Levine, which is absolutely brilliant. It's a trauma resolution model. Peter started off as a stress researcher, and so he started to recognize various patterns in the body, how our autonomic nervous system deals with stress. So one of the most important things that he looks at how we naturally regulate our body, mind, being, you know, how we, when something scary or threatening comes along, we kind of constrict and tense up. And at the same time, our, like the autonomic nervous system, the sympathetic branch, which is kind of like the gas of the car, speeds up so that we have more energy to do whatever we need to do to survive. And if threats continue to become even more threatening, then we're going to kind of, we can't fight or flight, we will go into freeze, kind of our last-ditch effort to survive, freeze and shut down. And how our system, how this is a very natural thing for our body, mind, being to do. It's not an aberration. Nothing bad is happening. In fact, these are our survival strategies. We're designed to do this. Now, designed to do this means designed to survive. It doesn't mean that it's designed to thrive, that we often need to heal afterwards from overuse of that system. When that system gets stressed too much, too frequently, we're going to have some healing to do. And that's where something like somatic experiencing will come in. It's like, let's kind of notice where your system got stuck and what that feels like and how that impacts you. And it's not about talking about it. It's, can I support you to feel that in your body? To bring awareness to that, somatic awareness, so that you become more aware of stuff. Like when I came into the somatic experiencing program as a student, it's kind of a difficult story. My husband had been diagnosed a year and change before that with stage 4 cancer. Now, thank God my husband survived. Unbeknownst to me, because I didn't really understand what had happened, I had gone into freeze in my terror of what would happen to my husband, whether he would live or die. I went into freeze. I felt helpless. I felt numb at times. I didn't know this, but I was really bracing really, really tightly in my body. And it wasn't until I went into the somatic experiencing classes that things started to do the opposite. They started to ease. And it was almost like a flood got going. I started feeling feelings that I hadn't felt in a really long time. It did not feel good, I will say. I felt that rebellious energy of like, oh my God, I feel like I'm 12 years old again. I have all of these rebellious feelings. I want to fight everything. But that was part of my journey, was coming out of freeze was about fight. And I'm so mad, and I'm so mad at everything I've been through. And that was part of what needed to heal. So this thing that happens in our body of this movement from things are difficult and I kind of contract and I get tighter. And then as things ease, I ease, my body eases, my breath flows more easily, I'm more relaxed. Something in me feels a little safer. It's a little safer to have feelings. It's a little safer to be curious about people outside of you. So Peter Levine noticed all of this and that it was very natural and that you could support people, especially people like for whom some aspect had changed. Something had changed, but it's almost like your body, mind, being didn't catch up to the change. It was still acting as though everything was happening at the same time. It had lost its flexibility to notice. It was less safe half an hour ago and more safe right now, and then less safe an hour from now, kind of thing. It had lost the ability to respond to your environment. This also maps onto our attachment system, that the tendency to tighten up is often associated with more anxious strategies And the tendency to numb out is often associated with avoidance strategies. That's the work of Phil Shaver, Mario Michelinzer, Marsha Hazan, Jude Cassidy. They mapped the attachment system onto the HPA axis. Peter Levine works with the autonomic nervous system, which rules the HPA axis. When you take all this stuff together, you have a trauma resolution model that also takes into account attachment. And that's kind of like where I fit in. Like, I had studied all this attachment and then SC, and I was like, oh my God, you just helped me to understand how we can work with the attachment system. Also, Peter's really clear, attachment traumas that we live through as kids are traumas. And we respond to them with attachment stance, and that's like a traumatized stance. Your baby nervous system was traumatized, so you developed that trauma reaction of either becoming really anxious about interpersonal relationships or really avoidant or both. I know that was, I just said a lot, but.
No, that was, I think you hit so many of the things that we wanted to talk about, and I loved it. It was so comprehensive, and you're able to bring in both attachment, SE, and for someone that's not in the program and speaking to the people that are used to more of like a talk therapy, or I personally do internal family systems, which I think is a little bit a part of SE, right? Yeah. So there can be a feeling, I think, from a lot of people seeking these healing modalities or therapies of, you feel initially like, I just need to talk this out. I need to tell someone what happened to me in a safe place where I feel heard. I don't feel like I can vent to my venting. It feels like venting to your friends, your family. Maybe they're a part of it. So you don't want to vent to the person that has hurt you. Or what soothes people in those moments, because SE isn't doing that. SE is not talking through everything that just happened this week, where you're, from my understanding, getting into that feeling where that's holding in the body. How can we soothe that feeling instead? And so how do you meet people who are coming from a space of, oh, I just need to vent?
Yeah. So it's a really important question. And I think that SE-informed psychotherapy or IFS-informed psychotherapy or another modality I do, interrelationship focusing-informed therapy, is all still therapy. And, you know, when you think about Peter Levine in one of his books, In an Unspoken Voice, talked about 9 elements of an SE session. And the first element is establish an environment of relative safety. Now, for some of us, that'll be months of talking. We just need to talk. Now, that doesn't mean that there would be no aspects of somatic experiencing that the clinician is bringing in, because they're probably, like myself, would bring in rhythm, pausing, taking time and space differently than before I learned somatic experiencing. So before I learned somatic experiencing, I might, without realizing it, allow someone to go deeper and deeper and deeper into something that was traumatic for them, or speak about many, many events that they had lived through early on in a treatment without realizing, or maybe realizing, but not exactly knowing what to do, where now I might say, can we pause? Let's spend some time with what you've just said. That was a lot. I'm wondering what it's like for you to just speak about it. So the use of pausing, rhythm, adding time and space, even if you're not going directly into the body, even if what you're doing is supporting talking because the person really, really wants and needs to talk, we're going to do that kind of differently if we are trauma-informed or somatic experience, you know, informed by somatic experiencing. Or I think IFS, I don't know IFS well, but I imagine IFS also is going to have some way of addressing that just talking you may want to, but the talking itself I've had many people come in and say, I want to talk about this, and then dissociate three sentences in. Or I can see them moving towards shutdown, or I can hear the urgency increasing in their voice. Now I will respond to that by taking time, space, checking what it's like for someone, slowing things down, making sure that the person is more available, like really letting them know we have time. It doesn't need to all come out at once. And in fact, your body will probably thank you for slowing down a little bit. And so I think of it as just using the concepts while also supporting a person to do some of what they need to do, which might be to be heard, to be heard in something they haven't been able to speak about before.
Something Gabby and I were chatting about the other day was how when we support clients, a lot of – we work with women primarily, but they are in such a rush to heal. And there's that like sense of urgency, which I have definitely experienced myself. It's like, can I just be better already? We tend to work with women who struggle with a lot of very physical symptoms. And I've been through the Embody Lab somatic parts training, and I'm currently in their somatic attachment training that I think you've been a part of as well in the past. And I'm forgetting her name right now, and I feel so bad, but I was just listening to one of the recordings on inner relationship focusing. And you've kind of used some of that language already, like there's a something here that feels more ease in my body. There's a part of me. And the language of internal family systems too. I'm curious for anyone who may be new here as a listener and is just getting to know this body of work, would you be able to break that down and how that intertwines and integrates with somatic experiencing?
Yeah, they're two really, really interrelationship focusing, which was developed by Ann Weiser Cornell and Barbara McGavin, and somatic experiencing, developed by Peter Levine, share a common ancestor. Both have the same creator of Eugene Genlin. So Eugene Genlin, who was working like in the 50s and 60s, I think of as the ancestor of all embodied work. His work in, he noticed some things about psychotherapy where people who tended to kind of talk and then kind of check into their body and say, is that right? No, you know, that wasn't quite the right word. It was more like this. And he noticed, and he did some research that showed that people that did that were successful in psychotherapy. And people that did not do that were not. And he said, what can I do to help people who aren't doing this naturally to do this? And he came up with a technique called focusing. And so focusing was about sensing into your body for what he called a felt sense. And the simplest definition of a felt sense is a meaningful bodily sensation. And so he located the area of transformation as the body rather than more traditional models, which were kind of like about reflection. Let's reflect on our thoughts, etc. Genlin was like, let's look for that embodied experience. So a number of therapeutic modalities and experiential methods emerged from that. Peter Levine's somatic experiencing, which is based on the technique of focusing, but applied to the autonomic nervous system. And then Peter, you know, integrated lots of other things with that. Ann Weiser Cornell and Barbara McGavin's inner relationship focusing, which moved to toward a somatically based parts work model. And so we're going to use that felt sense to feel in to the partial self states from an experience of self and presence. Now, anyone who's studied IFS is going to say, I'm starting to recognize that one. That one sounds a lot like internal family systems. Because internal family systems, based in Pearl's work and inner relationship focusing based in Genlin's work, are like cousins who are so similar who share so much in common. So these three modalities have a lot in common. From my perspective, interrelationship focusing brings the relational, which so many of us need. We want to have a relationship with the something in me that wants, like, say you have like something in you. I want a relationship. I want a healthy relationship. And then you have another something in you that's like, yeah, but I also want a really successful career. Those two somethings may come up with strategies that at times feel mutually exclusive, because it's almost like one is fighting for what it wants and the other's fighting for what it wants, not really hearing each other. And that the focusing experience allows you to be with each. Interrelationship focusing, IFS, I'm sure would do this as well, allows you to be with each of those experiences with interest, with curiosity, with compassion, without placing one as more important than the other. And that's really important, because a lot of our inner life can degenerate into this goal is more important than that goal. And then we start letting go of important things about ourselves, as though we've decided this is more important than that. But that's actually kind of a false thing, you know, that we need to slow down and say, I want to hear all of this. And I want to hear what the wants are, what the needs are, what the fears are. And when you come from an interrelationship focusing perspective, I'm going to start in my body. I'm going to start with the experience I'm having in my sensations, in my emotions. I'm going to start there. And that's going to keep me on course for feeling really deeply in touch with what I'm working with and avoiding the pitfall of going just to your thoughts. So SE will come at it from a slightly different perspective and say, when we support the nervous system to come into better regulation, we are much better prepared to deal with those relational themes. And when we have not yet really supported the nervous system to more fluidly move from activity to rest and back again, and it's all muddled up and it's all the things are happening at the same time, it's really hard to work through those relational issues. And so from Peter Levine's perspective, when we first support the nervous system to come into regulation, we are better prepared for that relational work later. The somatic parts work, interrelationship focusing, and the less somatically oriented IFS, but more developed in some ways, will come at it almost from the opposite perspective of let's support the being with the strengthening the experience of self being with the parts as a way to support the nervous system to regulate. Now, I, of course, was like, I don't want to have one or the other. I want both of those. And if I can be with my clients and support them to be in their nervous system, work directly with the nervous system, and also with the somatic experience of parts work, I think that that's the best of both worlds, especially coming from a pretty strong attachment background and kind of recognizing that somatically based parts work is like attachment work with yourself. We often think of attachment work as needing to happen interpersonally. But the origin of attachment work was with Bowlby. And Bowlby not only talked about your internal working models of other, how I see you is going to have an impact on how I relate to you. He also talked about the internal working model of self. How I view me is going to have a big impact on how I relate to me and how I relate to the world. Interrelationship focusing and likely IFS directly address this internal working model. How I view myself is how I perceive the world, is how I relate to you, And I can be with that. I can notice that in my own system, and I can work with that directly. And I can feel that better than anyone can feel that, because I'm living in this body. So I have everything I need to begin that work. And both Essie and IRF are partnered models. You sitting across from me are so important to helping me be with me and stay with me. So they relate beautifully to each other, all of these models.
I think it really goes back to the more work that we can do. I don't even like using the word work anymore. What's the word I can use? The more healing we can do, sometimes it feels very rigid. The more we can understand ourselves, the more we're able to show up in our relationships, and then we also heal in relationship. Because we know the parts of us, I'm just using IFS speak just for lack of full understanding of SE, but the parts of us we can understand those parts of us, and then we can then explain them ideally to our relationships and the people we're in relationship with. And then tying in attachment, again, it's all so fascinating, but tying in attachment. Kiara and I were talking recently. We were talking about how in ways, and I'll speak for myself, in ways growing up, my mom was the sole caregiver for most of my childhood. And so she was incredible. And my needs felt very met. My emotional needs felt very met. I would say she probably had more anxious tendencies with my understanding now, but my needs felt very met. I slept in bed with her until she got remarried, essentially, when I was in high school. She spoke for me. And so I was very shy. When someone would ask my name, if I didn't say it right away, she would say, "Oh, her name's Gabrielle." And so there's a confusion of, is there a level of giving too much as a parent, too much support, too much, where that can still lead to an insecure attachment? Or is that insecure attachment perhaps from my dad abandoning us? Maybe that's all where it's from, but it's so confusing to think of as a parent, and we're not moms yet, but I think that's in hopefully both of our futures, God willing. And is there a level, that can then lead to a child not feeling secure within themselves to make their own decisions, to speak, to, you know, move towards the cure?
I think it's complex, you know, because like even given that example, which is a great example, I would imagine, and, you know, I wouldn't know this, but I would want to check it out, of like, there could be a wound by one parent leaving. A wound that says, you know, I don't feel so great. You know, what would happen that someone who loved me, that I loved, could just leave like that? And then the other parent, and I'm thinking we've all seen this many times, almost like so doesn't want that for their child that they try to heal the wound created by another being. And that doesn't always work so well, because sometimes in that position, you could almost like overcompensate and try to keep rescuing or saving your child from that difficult experience. And every time you imagined your child feeling rejected, if you swooped in and were like, "You're not rejected, you're loved," or "You don't have to speak for yourself, I will speak for you," and never maybe supporting you or not adequately supporting you to take risks because they just didn't want you to feel that pain that you had experienced previously. I think of it like that could form a not so great loop. It's a loop of love, but one that doesn't necessarily let you grow, you know? And I do think a lot of times when we really look at it, people, the way they treat each other often has deep in its root some survival strategy. You know, like even things that look pretty awful, you can hear when you talk to a person about it, you might hear an unusual idea around someone needing to be protected from something that they had lived through. And then kind of having a misguided belief that they were going to help someone by treating them in this way. And so we come from our wounds, and then we kind of create messes as a result of that. And then thankfully, we also have opportunity as adults to heal. And then there's that hard thing. And I remembered earlier, you said something about people being impatient to heal. And impatience, I think of as like pretty much everyone who, I remember myself early in psychotherapy, just being so impatient to heal. Like, come on, why is this taking so long? There must be something wrong. And not really having embraced at that point, which I have finally embraced, is this is a lifelong journey. You know what? I'm never going to be better. And in fact, I was never broken. So both things, you know, that at this point in my life, I can say I wasn't broken. And yet I've done so much healing. And I also know that that healing is a gift. It's a gift of this life. It's a gift that my life will end before I have healed fully of everything I've lived through. And that's a gift, because the healing itself and our ability to do that, to seek it out, to participate in that, our desire to participate in that is so incredible. And it's such a gift that we can continue to grow for our entire lives when we embrace that this is a part of our journey. And why rush? You know, what's the rush? I mean, I know when I was in my 20s, if you said that to me, I'd be like, what's wrong with you? You know, of course I'm in a rush. I want to be better. But now, many decades later, it's sort of like I get how I felt in the 20s. And I'm really glad that I did a lot of work in my 20s. And I also think of it as like, then it really was work. Now it's much more, there's a joy that comes later with the work. It doesn't mean it's not without pain. There's suffering involved in work. But at this point, I kind of embrace that that's a part of growth. Growth is not always comfortable. But what happens in the process of growing is incredible. It's a real gift of this life.
Yeah, suffering is something that I'm currently just getting curious about, and going through a period of time myself that is very uncomfortable, very uncomfortable. And it's in these moments where I want to escape, like whether that's through a coping mechanism or I tend to actually have more self-critical thoughts as opposed to like distracting myself. Like my go-to response is like criticizing, like that inner critic part of me, something in me, it just wants to beat myself up, causing further suffering. And so how can we, of course, suffering is a part of the journey. It is a part of, like, there would be no growth if there were no suffering. But is there a way to not almost like drown in it, like the catastrophic thoughts? And I guess coming from like an interrelationship focusing perspective too, like building a relationship with this part of me, this inner critic part of me that wants to just beat me down.
Yeah, it is so important. And I think so many of us, myself included, suffer from the inner critics. And really, I do think that interrelationship focusing has a beautiful way of being with the something in me that's saying all this bad stuff about me, criticizing me, and the something in me that's being criticized. And so taking the time to hear from both of those, both the one that's criticizing, who in interrelationship focusing, we say, I bet that one is worried. I bet that one is concerned about something. I bet there's something it's not wanting to have to go through, not wanting you to have to experience. And when we can kind of sit with that of what is that part of you afraid of, not wanting to have to live through. It's often like, you know, I think of how parents will sometimes say to kids, you're going to fail if you don't study. And in interrelationship focusing, that would be seen as a worried parent who's basically saying, I'm so afraid that you're going to fail if you don't study. And I don't want you to have to go through that failure. But that's not what's said. What's said is actually angry. You are going to, you know, it's like a prediction of some terrible thing. When we hear our inner critics, it's kind of like that. They're telling us something bad is going to happen, but they're leaving out the, I'm afraid that this is going to happen, and I don't want you to have to go through this. And when we can slow down enough to hear and to ask, like, what is it that you're so scared of? What are you worried about? We can sometimes hear that, and we want to hear it without judgment, without evaluation, without a, well, that's stupid, that's not going to happen. More like, oh, I get that that's scary for you. I get you really don't want me to have to go through that. And then also to spend time with the one that's been hearing, you're going to fail, these bad things are going to happen, because that one, that part of us is often deeply wounded, often agrees, you're so right, I'm going to fail. It's often a less verbal or even nonverbal experience of pain and wounding or collapse or physical, like pain in your stomach, pain in your chest. It often has that experience of being wounded by those kind of blows that the critic has been inflicting. That part of us feels those bodily. Sometimes certain models kind of forget that we actually need to be with that part too. That part has been deeply wounded and is a somatic experience, often a nonverbal experience. So it's kind of like we want to talk with the worried one and really hear it, not tell it to feel differently, just hear it. We forget sometimes that that's what we most need when we're worried, is just to have someone say, oh, I really hear that. That's really scary for you. Not talked out of it, just that's really scary for you. And then also sitting with the one who's been wounded by that. And all of this kind of slows things down and has everyone related to. And often that can support an easing in the whole system so that it doesn't get bigger and bigger and bigger with more and more and more critics, but rather it's slowed down to, oh yeah, of course that's scary for you. I totally get that. And there's now something in me that's wounded that needs to heal, and we can support that. So I think that that interacts then with somatic experiencing, which is just like, oh, now we're kind of restoring that self-regulatory rhythm and allowing the body to move into a more regulated space that includes both the ability to move and to act and then settle and rest. And so all of it can have you kind of in a better shape to kind of get, oh, you just went through some little thing inside yourself. And we can support that to heal and to get that. It's almost like when you come home and you say, hey, I'm going to do this big new thing. And someone in your family is like, oh my God, and comes up with every bad thing that could happen as a result of you taking that new path. And then an hour later, your family member might be like, you know, I've been thinking about it. And even though all those scary things could happen, some really good stuff could happen too. We're like that with ourselves, only we play all the parts, you know? And sometimes we need to slow down enough to hear all the fears and all the potential woundings and slow down enough to say, oh, and I can be with all of that. And you know what? I can even still take this action. So it's about learning to better attend to ourselves. And that's about having a secure attachment with yourself that says, I can have a fight and then I can move into repair. I can do something really mean to myself, like criticize myself, and then I can move into repair and listen and be with. And now I'm developing a more secure relationship to myself.
There are, for people who have experienced a lot of trauma and stress in their lives and maybe have a tendency towards shutting down or maybe just shrinking themselves out of fear, they more than likely have a difficult time being able to express themselves freely and safely. And when I first got into the trauma healing space, I had this idea in my head that trauma was just going to be released from our bodies. And like, I had no idea what that looked like. Often cathartic, I guess. Like, and I know with SC, it's so different. And when we're meeting these aspects of ourselves, these parts of ourselves, the inner critic or the younger part of me that was abandoned as a child, what is the trauma release there? What does that actually look like?
Well, it's funny because in SE, I don't think of it as trauma release at all. And it's the restoration of rhythm. You know, it's not always emphasized enough, but I think in my own work, I actually emphasize this a lot, that the restoration of the rhythm from activity to rest and back again is what allows us to move out of freeze, out of fight, out of flight, out of insecure attachment. That movement towards action and the movement towards rest when we have insecure attachment and or trauma becomes so intertwined that we can't rest because we have this hypervigilance and action under our rest. So rest is not restful. And we can't act when we have a desire to act because we're totally exhausted and fatigued. We wind up tired and wired like 24/7, whether we are trying to act, whether we're trying to rest, it all feels kind of crappy. They're so muddied up. With somatic experiencing, that original support is to clear so that when you are resting, you're resting and you're not acting. And when you're acting, you're not exhausted and trying to shut down. And that takes a while. Like in what you described, when we feel really shut down, something in us doesn't want to act at all. And even getting that rhythm of movement from the something that is resting to the something that is acting, even while we are sitting there feeling tired and wired and exhausted, and the movement towards feeling one and then the other, feeling one and then the other with just a little pause in between, is the beginning of the reestablishment of that rhythm. And the rhythm itself is healing. Nothing is lost. It's more like a loop that's clarified. And in its clarification, we feel more energy when we're in a more active phase and more rested and restful when we're in the rest and restore phase. But I think of it like an infinity loop is how I think of it. It's continuous. It can fall out of rhythm and it can be supported to move back into a more supportive rhythm. And that we never fall completely out of rhythm. Our rhythm gets messed up and it can be supported to be in a more healing place. And for me, that's like really healing because it's like, okay, I can fall off track for maybe I have something difficult in my life and I can't sleep for 3 days and I feel exhausted during the day as a result. And then I'm able to do something that makes a difference and I sleep a little more. And then I'm more enlivened during the day and the rhythm starts moving in the other direction of more supportive, more healthful, more healing. And I think that's Peter's idea, is that getting that rhythm back into a healthy, supportive rhythm supports us to heal. And then we're ready for some of the deeper emotional work, having supported our nervous system to come into a better place. And that it's the recognition that you can literally be in shutdown and do that work. You know, I got really sick this past winter and went into complete shutdown for a few weeks. I had some terrible flu. And at first it was like, I can't even get out of bed. And I was like, you know what? There are some things I can do from bed. And that includes feeling the something in me that's like exhausted and doesn't want to move and is completely shut down. And feeling the something in me that sometimes is feeling scared or sometimes is feeling like, I just wish I could go for a walk. Whatever it was, I could do that while laying in bed. I could support the rhythm of my body to begin to restore. And every day it got better, it got better, it got better as I was getting better. And so the great thing about somatic experiencing is you could literally be in shutdown and do this work in a way that's supportive of your nervous system beginning to move back into a more supportive rhythm.
This has been so informative and lovely. And I can feel, I don't know about you, Gabby, but I feel like my nervous system is just so settled and at ease. Even though we've been talking a lot, there's just a something in me that feels way more easeful just hearing everything in the way you've laid it out for us today and your voice. Everything has just been so supportive. Maureen, thank you. For those who are wanting to work with you, where can they learn more about interrelationship focusing?
Yeah, you can go to my website, MaureenGallagherPhD.com. And I list there my upcoming trainings. I usually run trainings in the spring and again in the fall. Sometimes I have short programs in addition to that. I would be happy for people to check out my trainings. You can write to me. You can find out more. I have another website, embodyingpsychotherapy.com, where you'll see somatic experiencing group case consults and some SE-related work. Although for SE itself, you go to traumahealing.org, where you'll find that I'm an instructor.
So grateful. Thank you so much. I feel like I was in a trance. You have so much like good
wisdom.
Yeah. Wisdom is the word.
Yeah.
Like just, yeah, the way that you've explained things, I think is a lot different than I've heard in the past and brought a lot of clarity. So thank you.
Thanks for having me. It was great to spend this time with you.
Thank you so much for listening. Maureen is a wealth of knowledge. And again, like I mentioned in the intro, it just, you feel enthralled by her. And we hope that you just felt really held in her energy just as much as we did. You can find all the info about how to connect with Maureen in the show notes. And also, another ask is if you could rate and review the podcast. We are so grateful for every single one that we receive. It really helps us bring on the best guests possible, and we're so appreciative.
And in case you guys haven't heard about Gabby Nice freebie that we've put together for you, it's a two-part freebie focused on digestion because we know y'all really struggle with digestion. We want to help you out in any way that we can. It's called Digesting Well. So that form for you is available in the show notes so that you can download it and get started with a two-part freebie. So Gabby put together a mini lesson on digestion, and I put together a somatic audio practice that you can carry with you at mealtime because that's when it's best used so that you can really settle in to the space that you're in and really bring your system into the state of ease and safety as your body preps for digestion. So again, that's available in the show notes. And if you're ready for more, don't forget about our course that we've created for you, Body Basics. We're so, so excited about this course, you guys, because it really encompasses everything that Gabby and I love to preach about. And that is simplifying the health principles as much as possible so that it's not overwhelming for you in your day-to-day. It really comes back to these basic foundations. You'll never get away from them. I don't care how advanced you are. It really is always about coming back home to the basics again and again. So you can click the link in the show notes to join the course, and we would love to see you inside. We'll see you next time, guys.